at the Alleyway Bar, 2415 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor La Segua, running February 7th to March 2nd at the Milagro Theater in Portland. La Segua is a Central American cautionary folktale of a young, beautiful woman whom philandering men encounter on their way back home. Her beauty decays into a horror that drives the men mad. The play tells the story of a beautiful woman who was haunted by the specter of La Segua and takes a hard look at Costa Rican values, including ambition, hypocrisy, and follows themes of machismo, vanity, and narcissism. Again, that's La Segua, running February 7th to March 2nd on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights at 7:30 and Sundays at 2 p.m. at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland.
Hello, listen to Wider Window Poetry, bringing you voices you may not have heard from places you may not have been. I'm your host, Teal Ansari, and today we have for you a couple of poets. First, I'm going to read a couple poems by an interesting poet, and then I'll introduce our live guest. And the poems I'm going to read today are by Ankita Anand. She's a writer-poet based in Delhi, India. She's been an invitee to the International Poetry Festival, Andhra Pradesh, and the Multilingual Poetry Festival in Kerala, India. She's also a recipient of the European Commission's Lorenzo Natali Media Prize and a fellow with the Washington-based group The Rules, and she blogs at indieblogger.in. Ankita Anand. I'm going to read two poems by her. And this first one is titled Metamorphosis. Politicians double up as salons offering makeovers. If today you ask a city its name, it will look into your eyes seductively and ask, what do you want it to be? I could be Shanghai, or are you in the mood for Singapore? And though you know that while the grass on your side is burnt or stunted, none grows on the other side, you'll allow yourself to be coiled up and swallowed. You'll want to take this one decision to end the pretense that you're the one taking the decisions. You'll wish to do away with the stressful delusion of being in control, knowing you were the one being kept in control. You'll give in gratefully in that most vulnerable moment in the day when you're shivering, anywhere but here, anywhere but here. And the second poem is titled Grounded. I am worried my grandmother doesn't sit, and she is afraid to. After all these years of having been kept on her toes, waiting on others' hand and foot, she says she'd no longer be able to stand if she sits down now. If I sit, I shall remain sitting. Ankita Anand, look her up online. Today's guest is Dorothy Black Crowe, who has published more than 50 poems, took first place poetry at the Pacific Northwest Writers Conference. Her poem Wind Cave 2, Time of Emergence was nominated for a Pushcart Prize. And her chapbook, Anuk Ite, Double-Faced Woman from Turnstone Press, was a finalist in two poetry contests. Dorothy has supported poetry and literature in Oregon as director of Willamette Writers Coast Branch, director of Writers on the Edge, board member for the Oregon Poetry Association and the Poets Concord, as well as Willamette Writers and editor for Calyx. She has taught at the Illinois Institute of Technology, University of Michigan, Oglala Lakota College, Lynn Benton, Oregon Coast Community College, and Oregon State University HMSC Summer Session, and she continues to lead creative nonfiction workshops for Willamette Writers, Oregon Writers Colony, and Writers in the Schools, a huge asset to Oregon's literature community. She's been published in Fiction, Folio, Fireweed, Literary Review, Shaman's Drum, Sideshow, Spa, Sun, and Ziziva. Those were in alphabetical order, in case you didn't notice, besides several anthologies. She was featured in the Oregonian Poetry Column in 2014 and has received numerous awards, including a Walden Fellowship, Literary Arts Council grant, and Writers in Residence. So I'd like to welcome Dorothy Blackcrow. Take it away, Dorothy.
Thanks for being here. And thanks for inviting me to start reading some of my poetry. I have one book out and one book, another book coming. So, how shall we begin?
Yeah. We'd like you to read some poetry.
Okay. It's too bad people can't see the cover of this, but Teal, you can see the cover of this. This is my first book of poetry, Anukite, which is Lakota for double-faced woman. And in Lakota, double face has two meanings. It can be life and death, or it can be nice and mean. This is in honor of Ethel Black Crow, who's passed on, and she was a quill maker, and that's one of the first poems I composed to honor her. And maybe I'll begin by reading it, since it's from the anthology itself. Okay. Okay. Double Face Woman. In memory of Ethel American Horse Black Crow, a Lakota quill worker. They warned me not to dream of her, Anukite, the double face woman, filling us with terror as young girls. But after my fifth miscarriage, I didn't care. Let the other women bead tiny lizards for their babies or cut cottonwood twigs for childbirth. I began to dream for Anukite. I called and called, drank teas, dark, but when she drifted in, I did not know her. On the right side, moist lip, bright eye, for she would not turn her head. At last, I dreamed her fierce side, her bone side reached right through the black eye socket, plunged my elbow deep to pull out all those designs pricked in the night sky. Quilled whorls and stars pulled into my mind. My arm did not wither because I did not touch bone, but I had known darkness, so I was gifted to work with quills, my hand steady, not pierced by the black barb. Now in a house no man may enter, we boil dyes, steaming roots, bitterberry red, wormwood black, and ochre yellow. We weave black barbs and white shafts, our lips moist, swollen from sucking quills flat, sucking medicine, pahin woshkapi, porcupine quill work. We are fierce, we are childless. Men do not bother us. We are sharp, we pierce, we prick, we know the designs.
Thank you.
And was Ethel American Horse Black Crow one of your kin?
I have about 13 poems here, but I don't think that I should probably read all of them. I was going to end with Gift of the Healing Darkness, but the one that has been published most the most, besides the one I just read, is Wind Cave 1 and 2. And so this poem came about because we were working at Oglala Lakota College with our minority science students, and we were going to take them to Wind Cave up in Rapid City or around Rapid City in the Black Hills to show them the geological formations of helictites and stalagmites and things like that. And some of the students who were very traditional said they couldn't go inside the cave because it belonged to Grandmother Earth. And I thought, oh, right. So I wrote this poem, Wind Cave 1. Inside Grandmother Earth's lungs, we enter from a door blasted in her side, down metal stairs, past folds of fleshy flowstone, stepping on the lungs of a great giant, Grandmother Earth, Wind Cave, at the center of all that is. The first explorers had to crawl down her windpipe to get inside, past her whistle, past her sigh. Wind so strong it blew their hats off, blew their lamps out. Now the throat's blocked to keep young children from falling through its 18-inch membrane. Cords cut. The cave is songless, speechless. Like a virus, we swarm the lungs, creep past the silence, twist deeper into holes and folds, past brown mud-breathing skin. We penetrate dry air pockets, smoke-blackened, pickaxed, narrowing down, 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 till no air sacs left, nothing. And since that's such a gloomy version, Wind Cave 2, Time of Emergence. And this is the one that was Pushkar Award. Okay. All right. The buffalo sank into the earth when the bounty men came, slaughtered for tongues. They disappeared. Whole herds hid in caves, shrunken-hearted, waiting without grass, hooves still in the rock. Rough dark hairs rub the walls. Bodies jostle for air from Grandmother Earth's windpipe. Pipestone, that soft red rock, some say, is the blood of Mother Earth, is the blood of the first people, is the blood of mammoth bison, where the last herds shape-shifted small and disappeared. Others say they know of a cave where piney bison shuffle and wait, near White River, Rosebud, Red Scaffold, or Ring Thunder, a cave in the Badlands Clift by the river, fossil hoofprints in the shale. But I know the place of emergence, the center of all that is, this time, Wind Cave. When we rise up from the earth again, we will not need the stairs.
Nice.
So that's that one. I have a poem that's written for Judith Barrington, who was a great mentor for me, not only as a poet, but as a memoirist and as a writer of songs. So one time she forced me to write a villanelle, and so I had to do it. And I went home and the mangled sheet of paper turned into this one called Villanelle for CeeLo. Now, if you had the book, you would see how handsome he is. was. Anyway, he lured me away from the University of Michigan to South Dakota, Pine Ridge, Camp Crazy Horse, and the idea of raising buffalo, which we finally did. So, Villeneuve Cello, who was gone now at this time, he is 10 years gone. Okay. And I have a Lakota prophecy as the epigraph. Bring back the buffalo so the people will not starve. And that was my mantra for many years. I never dared to tell you this before. I chose you for your sacred dream of a buffalo herd. That's what I prayed for. Not you, world-weary and poor, though full of passion and eyes agleam. I never spoke of my own dreams before we fenced the prairie till we could work no more. Cursed each other in blizzards so extreme that the buffalo herd was what I feared for. Yet the herd was impossible to ignore, driving us to fight until we worked as a team. I never spoke of my despair before they vanished into the Badlands. To restore the herd, we chased them, hoping to redeem the lost buffalo. That's who I cried for. Though they're gone, it's us who must endure the work, the weather, release the dream. I never dared to tell you of my love before. It was you, not the buffalo, that I lived for. That's a sad ending. The herd did get loose in the Badlands umpteen times, and umpteen times we chased them on horseback, on foot. You can't chase them with snowmobiles because they make too much noise, so the herd really does disappear before you get it back to the pasture. So after I moved to the reservation, my father wondered what had happened to me. I had disappeared into a log cabin with a dirt floor and no electricity or running water. And so this is a poem dedicated to Nellie Hedog Black Crow near Rosebud, South Dakota, and it was 1981. And it's called Christmas at Uppercut Meat. Okay. My father came for Christmas on the res one year, flew 2,000 miles at 80 years just to see that I was fine. So Nellie Black Crow made sure that he was treated right, asked us over to Rosebud for Christmas evening church service at Uppercut Meat. A simple white hall, clapboarded by her husband Roy Black Crow, the first native lay reader in the Episcopal mission there. The bishops were proud of him, though the land was still Nellie's. Handed down from Hedog, her father, last of the Brule Band chiefs. Now Uppercut Meat, the best of the beef issue ration, red ribeye and top sirloin, was for the headmen who signed the treaty when no more bison surged over the plains. Not much here now, just a cluster of BIA houses, maybe 10, and the Black Crow Church. Freshly whitewashed, inside a tall cedar tree becomes the altar, decked with apples and popcorn, simple as evening service. Carols in Lakota, slow hymns, ancient verses. Roy's dead now. The new lay reader greets my father. Welcome, Elder Mac. Four boys with braids carry in big cardboard symbols, star, Cedar, Hoop of Sage, and Cross. Christmas story in the native tradition. Each child ties a shining gift to the tree for Jesus' life reincarnate here in Upper Cut Meat. All is well. At last, the midnight feast. Under the tree, gifts wrapped for each one here, plus apples, oranges, and walnuts for all. Names are called out, and then it's Elder Mac. Why, how'd they know I'd be here? His package thick, heavy, damp. A 2-inch slab of steak, raw, red, and marbled. Strange present won't keep. We get Bibles or Tupperware, troll dolls or trucks. But for the guest come 2,000 miles, the headman's honor, Upper Cut Meat. I love that one. Now, let's see. 1, 2, 3. I think I'm going to just there are more here. And you wanted American Horse?
Sure.
Okay. This is actually for two American horses. American Horse, one of the chiefs who signed the 1868 treaty with the U.S. government, and a friend of mine, Joe American Horse, who carries his name. American Horse. Fastest runner in Nebraska, Joe American Horse, cousin-in-law, Oglala Sioux tribal president, served the people humbly and fairly. We sit outside Ethel Black Crow's home in Potato Creek housing cluster while a Native American church ceremony ends in the basement. Ethel, the keeper of the buttons for South Dakota, trusted elder, cured of cancer by a peyote man way back when carrying her first child. On her living room wall hangs a big Smithsonian photo, 3 by 5 feet, a photo seated American Horse dead center, flanked by 2 wives, 5 sons like bodyguards. Ethel, perched on her mom's buckskin knee, is dressed European style in lace and pleated calico, unlike her stepsister, who has braids hanging to her waist. The name American Horse was earned in battle by grabbing a dead soldier's army brand horse or bringing back to the people the whole army herd. Proud name passed down 4 generations, probably now by 7. Church elder and healer, long-distance runner and leader, may the next kin bring honor to American Horse. And unwritten here, there was an American Horse at Standing Rock that welded himself onto one of the machines before, so they could not keep stopping the pipeline from continuing at that time. So I have one a more closing, and it's called Gift of the Healing Darkness. Now, I'm also a longtime Quaker, and in one of our gatherings, they were all talking about Gift of the Healing Light, Gift of the Healing Light, oh, Gift of the Healing Light. Well, I kept thinking, no, I know, that's fine, but I really like Gift of the Healing Darkness because I lived way out in the country where there was only moonlight. And when there was no moonlight, there was the gift of the healing darkness. So this has 5 little stanzas. The first one is Wachekia, which means praying. In the summer, buffalo pasture, deep black hulks rest in shadow, sacred herd. We drift past them out onto the land, no fear now of rattlers, checking tobacco ties on each post. All is well. We breathe night, mint in moonlight, touch hands, silence for miles. A hoop of peace surrounds us as we walk into the healing darkness. Inipi means being reborn. It also means the sweat lodge. Enclosed in sheets, we crawl through the low door, sit on sage round the center fire pit. Filled with glowing rocks, hissing and steaming, called born in ancient ones, Tunka Oyate. These rock faces smile wisdom, spit out truth. Songs call ancestral spirits in, glowing blue-green. Cold water and hot steam renew our hearts in Grandma Earth's round womb. Praying, we breathe into the healing darkness. 3. Lawampi, which means singing, and you don't sing, singing for healing. Okay. And this in a night meeting, it's a ceremony. Okay. In night meeting, as they nail the door shut, cover the windows with blankets, we tuck our feet in and sit still, sage over one ear. With kerosene lamp blown out, the drumbeat begins. Slow and deep, the heartbeat of Grandma Earth. So we become one ear, one heartbeat, one mind, to sing for all those in pain, sickness, grief, despair. We wrapped in the ancient songs, we sink into the healing darkness. 4. Hamblecha, which it means crying for a vision, and it's called Vision Quest these days. But Hamblecha, embraced by earth in deep vision pit, fasting 4 days and nights, surrounded by tobacco ties, altar, and silence, we lean against soft, warm dirt for strength, knowing only earth, the final blanket. Alone, we cry, holding the sacred pipe wrapped in sage. Wakan Tanka, great mystery, bring health, happiness, and good welfare to the people. We pray into the healing darkness. 5. Wanagayapi, which means going to the spirit land or taking the red road into the sky. In Badlands Cliffs above Ridgestone Basin, we find old bent willows, wooden pail, rock pile, cloth scraps, feathers, ancient praying place. Far below, fossil turtles, Clovis points, bison ribs. Thousands of hooves once trod this trail deep in the prairie. At night, spirit bison still stampede over the shuddering cliffs. As we follow their echo, we walk into the healing darkness. Thank you. And this book is for the teal, which has pictures in it as well. Yes.
Thank you.
And I brought I think you want to take a little break, and then I have 4 poems from my next book of poetry. It's not sure what it's going to be called, Coast Watches, or Ben Jones Bridge, or Bridge Over Nothing, or I tried this one on my daughter, and she said no, and it's oceanitis. No, it sounds, it's not a disease, it's a calling, but so that one won't go. I'm not sure what the title will be, but it won't be that one. So go ahead ask more about if you want to.
Yeah, so I noticed that in a lot of your poetry you speak about religious ritual, both Christian and Native religious rituals, and I wonder if you feel, as I do, that writing poetry in itself is a religious ritual or perhaps a religious practice.
Well, let's see. First of all, some people think I shouldn't write about the details in ceremony, but when I was taken into a New Age sweat lodge, I was actually appalled because people had bought, instead of picking sage, they had bought it. And instead of picking herbs, they had bought them, or they had pulled the whole root out. And I learned to be very, very careful with anything that one uses in a healing situation, we'll call it. And one of the things was to always take, and I don't smoke, I can't smoke, even though I cough a lot, to take a cigarette, and probably not a store-bought one, but one rolled in paper and tobacco, and the tobacco would be red willow bark that was rolled, and you would leave it where you picked part of a plant that would be part of a healing drink in a ceremony, and so you didn't just take the whole plant, you left it there so that in the next season or in the next week or the next month someone else needing it could find it there. So that was my take, and I thought, well, there are other kinds of ceremonies, and to this day there are other kinds of ceremonies that are hidden, and they're hidden because for exactly those reasons people just can't tromp in. There are sacred songs that can only, for example, be sung in winter. And so if you heard it and you captured it without permission and sang it in the summer, that wouldn't be a good idea. So so I feel very strongly about these ceremonies, and I try and be careful. The other reason I write about them is because they are so special. And in the olden days when I lived on Pine Ridge, I married into a family that only spoke Lakota. Now, that doesn't mean they didn't speak English. They spoke English when they wanted me to do something, but at the time, they only spoke Lakota, and they carried the language forward, and it was so beautiful. And I learned, of course, I had to listen carefully because I knew they were talking about me, and then I would reply in English. So, but I did learn, and so in those days, there were customs that I think have often disappeared today. Elders are always seated first. Elders are always served first. If you are a visitor, you don't start blabbing, like I'm blabbing right now in a way, but you learn to keep your mouth shut. So when I write about these, I'm writing about the days that were shared with me that are no longer there. And I have grandchildren who sometimes call me and they ask me, what's the Lakota word for uncle? And I thought, oh, Lekshi. Well, okay. I do remember, but I never really spoke fluently. But I did hold my own. Don't worry. So back to religion and poetry. I want to share that with the world without necessarily giving away too much information that someone would misuse. And And so this is not only in the Native circles at Pine Ridge in Lakota customs, but also now where I live on the West Coast, and am part of a Coast Salish tradition and a song carrier, and a member of certain healing groups. One that I go to but I don't belong is the Native American Shaker Church. They have such beautiful healing songs. So I'm blessed that way. And So I have this tradition. I have the Lakota tradition on it also. A sixth generation Quaker. So, but in Quaker, you don't sing, no, you sing, you sit in silence, and maybe the great mystery or the Holy Spirit encourages you to speak and stand up and speak, but mostly not. So with Quakers, there was a big dispute at one time about whether the piano could be in the meeting room where there's only silence. I was ministering oversight at the time, and we had two members who had Alzheimer's, and we had difficulty because although they had Alzheimer's, they had been used to speaking and meeting for so many years that they were incoherent. And so what I thought was, well, we do need that piano. We need that piano. We'll have to bring it out of the library. We'll put it in the living room. And at 10:30 before the 11 o'clock worship, we will sing hymns because the two people with Alzheimer's knew all the verses to Silent Night, all the verses to Joy to the World. Not me. No, we were just singing and singing, and pretty soon, Lulu, La La, and our Alzheimer's sang their hearts out. And then when we went into Quaker meeting, they were full. So they just sat quietly in silence. And that's what can happen with music. Music can heal. And that's just one almost humorous version, but it worked that time. So, yes, there are other things for example, I was given a name now, a Native name, a Coast Salish name, and mine is public, so I can say it out loud. As a matter of fact, in ceremonies, when I introduce myself, everyone else echoes me four times because that's when you really mean it. And so I should warn people, be very careful before you ask for a Native name. Switching back to the reservation, I never wanted a Native name, never, because I saw these people, they came and they got names that were in English, Rocks in His Head, that was Thomas Males, and other people. Oh, there was another woman that was a French woman, and she got the name Zuzicha Ishto, so that meant snake eyes, things like that. So, and I got teasing names, but so. And my Coast Salish name is carried on from Christine Moses, who in 1919 took her clan from, this was the time of the flu. It was coming, the terrible flu that came all across the United States and got to Vancouver Island. She took her clan and went across the water to Nooksack and to Mount Baker. And she took them high above the tree line into the snow, and all her clan survived the flu. She was a weaver, and she wove mountain goat wool blankets. So for many years, she did that, and she lived on Swinomish Reservation, and that's where that name came to reside. And I was given that name, and it is Stequalanata. And there it goes, clap, clap, meaning, It doesn't mean praise, no. It means go away, bad spirits. And so sti qua lanata means she who sows and sings as she sows and prays and then makes beautiful things to give out freely to the people. And I'm making a gesture with putting up my hands freely to the people. And that's my name. So that's my given name, and it's a public name. And thank goodness I have it. But what it meant was, oh dear, I give things out freely to the people, and sometimes I run out of money. but there it is. So other people have hidden names or private names, and they do not share them. And that's because that is their essence or power, and that's up to them if they ever choose to use that power or if they simply study that power. So that's what happened to me. Be careful about asking for an Indian name.
So you lived on the Lakota Reservation, which of course is very arid. It's, you know, the high plains, very different from the Oregon coast where you live now.
Mm-hmm.
Would you tell us something about the physical nature of those places? Did that influence your poetry at all?
Oh, yes. I lived out on the land. And the land was prairie, and it wasn't exactly flat. It had rolling hills, and it had cliffs and depressions and so on. But where I lived on the prairie, you could look 360 degrees around and see the whole sky, the whole world. You could see everything. You could see 30 miles away the town that was on the thruway. You could see every direction, so it was very expansive, and you did feel as if you were in the center of the world, which is what the Black Hills Paha Sapa is called, the center of the worlds, or more specifically, the center of all that is, because the rocks are so ancient there. Now, so I loved that. I really loved that. When I arrived in Oregon, I felt terribly cramped. I was caretaker of Quaker Meeting, but I was on a lot 100 feet by 150 feet, and I was used to taking care of 800 acres and beyond when the buffalo would get loose. So I felt really constrained and cramped, and everything was so pristine. The grass was pristine. It was cut with a toothbrush. With a shears, practically, everything was neat and orderly. But when I moved to the coast, I felt okay again, because there I was. I had moved all that way from childhood in New York State, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, all across the United States, and finally I landed in Morocco, which is not Morocco. Morocco, it means look at the rocks. And I, at the bottom of Cape Foulweather, on the Oregon coast, between Newport and Depot Bay, and so Cape Foulweather, the old volcano, has spewed lots of basalt rock everywhere. So we live on the rocks in this little cul-de-sac right near the ocean. Fortunately, there's a 60-foot cliff. And just recently, we had I do have a poem, but it's so silly. It's called Big Waves Are Back Again. It's one of those poems, kind of poems. I didn't bring it with me. But anyway, in December, we had big waves back again, which meant 40-foot waves and 70 mile an hour winds, and at the top of Cape Foulweather was 90 miles an hour winds. Anyway, I live oceanfront once we moved, fortunately. and it's still strong winds, but I look out and there are these humongous, beautiful waves coming all the way in. It's so different from the beach. And the beach, they half a mile out, they start breaking and they break and they break and they break. And then when they get to the sand, there's just foam. But in Morocco, the waves come directly in from Japan and they crash at the cliff and go boom, and the earth shakes, the house shakes, even the bed shakes a little bit. And then there's all the spume and spray, and it goes up 40 or 50 feet in the air. So I feel recovered again from the smallness of small lots to the immensity of the ocean. And when I moved here, I discovered I was going to study dissolution, because things dissolve, and we as people and dissolve eventually, and the ocean is there, and it is immense. It covers everything. We can learn so much from the ocean just by watching it, by walking into it, by not drowning. So I've written some poems about that. I don't know how our time is going.
We have plenty of time. So if you would like to read some of your ocean poems.
Okay, sure. Let's see. How do I want to... Oh, I'm going to start with... for many years in Newport, we had on January, we would have a William Stafford birthday party, a memorial birthday party, obviously. And we would invite people to bring their favorite William Stafford poems and read them aloud to each other. And then they could bring some of their own poems aloud and read them aloud to each other. And then we could eat. So I went to many poetry workshops, and I just had a hard time getting started. So because when I hosted these William Stafford Memorial birthday parties, I had to read William Stafford poetry and pick out my own favorites every year, which was horrendous because there's so many. Anyway, so I picked some of his lines and decided that I wouldn't write like him exactly. I would just use his lines as an epigraph. Ha ha. And then I could start my own. So I have two poems with William Stafford epigraphs. And the first is, the first is Believe in the Ocean. And this William Stafford line comes from one of his poems. Even the upper end of the river believes in the ocean. And I thought, oh, I like that one. And then I thought, oh, I have a poem for this. Okay. Believe in the ocean. I believe in the ocean. What's not to believe? 150 yards below my door, there's horizon high as wainscoting around an endless room of sky. When you go down to the beach, the ocean's at eye level, tame, even with tidal surge and spume. But if you climbed to the top of Cape Foulweather, the sea rises higher and higher with each step. My sister-in-law, Agatha Tallmandan, came from the South Dakota Plains to see if the ocean that her brother sailed on for 29 years was real. When I drove her over the last hill on Route 20 down into Newport, she grabbed the car door handle and hung on for fear of drowning. Forget about sneaker waves, neap tides, and tsunamis. That huge wall of water ahead, right there in Newport, rose up to swallow her. We'd call her naive, uneducated, but I say she believes in the ocean. Yeah. And here's another one I snuck in because I had another poem to write about it. Okay. This one is called "The Ocean Has Many Pebbles." And William Stafford's line is this: "The ocean and I have many pebbles to find and wash off and roll into shape." And of course, he was talking about poetry. But this one, "The ocean has many pebbles." He was talking about poems, but I'm talking about collecting real rocks. As a rock hound, I wore pants with 8 zipper pockets. I walked the beach looking down at the sand, not the water, the horizon, the sky, the seagulls, or sandpipers. Pebbles came into my hands, into my pockets, zippers secure. Cloudy agates, rusty red garnets, striped black and whites, and a fossil clamshell face, an unbedded shell roadrunner, limpet eyes peering out from basalt. Weighed down, I held my pants up, carried my treasures inland to anchor my home, each windowsill full of loot, rock medicine grounding me in place. When a medicine man came to visit, he stared at all the windowsills, and his mouth opened in a wide O. Oh. "You have a lot of rocks here," he said. "Where'd you get them?" "Rivers, ocean, I need them to feel safe from the outside world." "They're lonesome, too. Why not return them where they belong?" I hesitated. All my rocks. Not here. All my rocks, years worth of collecting. I don't know how to do this. I'm going to back up. Can you do that? That's just me. Okay. I'll start out. Rivers, ocean, I need them to feel safe from the outside world. They're lonesome, too. Why not return them where they belong? I hesitated. All my rocks, years worth of collecting. You could collect them in baskets, take them to the ocean, and offer them back. After he left, the house filled with longing. I piled my pebbles into baskets, baskets heavy with rocks, and carried them to face in the rock at Bend and Beach. Down the 99 steps toward the ocean, a heavy basket in each hand. Goodbye, smiley face. Goodbye, roadrunner. Goodbye, limpid eyes. Goodbye, agates and garnets. Goodbye. With each step. It was winter, and the tide came in. Before I could offer a prayer, a sneaker wave, waist high, breast high, knocked me over, grabbed both baskets and overturned them, spilling my treasures into the surf, the hungry surf. The woven baskets bobbed up, filled with seafoam, and sank. And that's some of the fun I've had. I do have two, one sad and one profound to read, and that'll be the end. The first is called Hold Fast, and Hold Fast is the name of a seaweed that hangs on to the rocks, called Sea Palms, and its name is called Postelia. So here we go. A colony of Postelia sea palms clings to the rocks below Cape Falwether. Washed by a rogue wave, dark green fronds dance in the wind amid a rush of foam, a suck of tide. Hold fast. Hold fast to rocks once lava hissing into the sea, roots so strong no sea crests can loosen. Hold fast. Hold fast, tide in, tide out, day and night, year after year, Postelia fed by a rogue wave, a surge of life diatoms and wetness. Without the tides, Postelia and we will perish. Hold fast. Now we are grieving. Two teenagers swept off the rocks at Smelt Sands Beach by a rogue wave. Honeymooners swept off the rocks at South Jetty by a rogue wave. Hold fast. We are grieving. And the last one is kind of a closure. A lot of people love to spend their time watching sunsets. Some people spend the time watching sunrises, and some watch sunsets. I do watch sunsets because I belong to the Green Flash Club, but I'm also interested in moonsets, and moonsets are rare, and they're rare partly because usually at 4 a.m. I'm asleep, many others also, and it has to be the full moon before it really counts. So I'm writing and giving you my take on the moon in a clear sky, and it's called Moonset. Nothing left but rocks and sea and sky. I set my course on you. Each clear night, as you toss your shimmering band down onto the water, you whisper, "Reach, catch me." How can I stretch my desolate arms up to you, so high and pale? No water wings to swim the air, no flippers to fly the waves. How can I walk on water? If I make silver slippers to slide on your ribbon to the edge of the sea, still I cannot reach you. How can I climb onto air? Each clear night, as you toss your shimmering band down onto the waves, you whisper, "Reach, catch me." I wait till you grow fat and lustrous, dropping down to rebirth yourself in the black waters of the night horizon. And as you drop, I catch you. I midwife you as you midwife me.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Thank you.
Yeah. KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Real Music Film Festival through February 16th at the Witzel Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. On Friday, February 8th, the Real Music Festival will screen documentary Industrial Accident, the story of Wax Trax Records. Wax Trax Records was founded in 1975, the beloved record shop and label that has been based in Chicago since 1978. This documentary by Julia Nash details the rise, temporary fall, and legacy of Wax Trax. Again, that's the Real Music Film Festival, showing Industrial Accident, the story of Wax Trax Records, on Friday, February 8th at 7 p.m. at the Witzel Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the second annual Quanise Hayes Angel Anniversary on Saturday, February 9th from 5 to 8 p.m. at the former DMV on 82nd Avenue in Portland. This is a candlelight vigil in loving memory of loved one Quanise Hayes. This event is for the family and friends to remember Moose. On February 9th, 2017, Moose was shot 3 times by police. He was only 17 years old. Bring flowers, candles, and balloons, and stories to the now-closed DMV office near the Banfield Pet Hospital on Northeast 82nd. Again, that's the second annual Quanise Hayes Angelversary on Saturday, February 9th from 5 to 8 p.m. at the former Oregon DMV building, 1836 Northeast 82nd Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland.
Radio Theater Project. Radio Theater Project. A radio drama series. Featuring comedy,
science fiction,
and mystery.
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 Old stories and new. Radio Theater Project.
Theater of the mind
for today.
Future Past, dramatized stories from the golden age of science fiction. What if you started seeing pink elephants for real and they're invading the Earth? Presenting The Invasion of the Pink Elephants, from a story by Fletcher Pratt, written by Laurie R. Vasquez.
Come on, you stupid machine, they're almost here.
We know you're in there, Marvin Suggs. Open up!
Damn it. It's working. Finally. This is Dr. Marvin Suggs of the planet Earth. We are under attack by the Rigelians. Repeat.